heaven surpass penetrating and perfect Dharma, it is rarely met with even in 100,000,000,000 kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Here we are. Thank everybody for coming. And thank everybody for putting us together, everyone who's contributed. From my distant perspective, everything seems to be going, each iteration of our little gatherings seems to be going more smoothly. And that's really great, because people are coming forward and making things happen. It's really cool, and I'm deeply appreciative of the effort. So, I was reflecting when we were doing our meal chant how, you know, we say just follow the schedule. And I was reflecting on the minute detail of following the schedule. It slowly breaks down to every breath we take. But initially, it may just be, it's time to get up. It's time to sit down. It's time to walk. It's time to say, Virochana Buddha. It's time to just be aware of my mudra. And these little forms, it's time to just say Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva when practicing, carry us through. The idea of the meal is we don't have any choice. There's just the food that's there and the plate that's there. And when it's just the food that's there and the plate that's there and the eating, it's pretty remarkable. It's almost like the light in the left corner of this picture up here. Over here. I think God's coming in through the window or something. But don't worry, God's not going to come through the window. But when we're caught in our confusion and our turmoil and our grumpiness or our sleepiness or our delusion of feeling good, just the next word in the chant. It's highly impersonal. It's meant to help us remove ourselves from our delusion of choice and to actually reflect our desires and our solidity, our foolish idea of solidity about ourselves and how we get caught. But then there's always the next moment. There's Virochana, then there's Lochana Buddha. And then Shakyamuni. But each moment, there's an opportunity and something to take us further along. And the opportunity to give ourselves over. And in a sense, learn how to float. And literally relax. Not relax like goof off. Relax like our entire body is awake and not driven by anxiety. Or it may just be that we're willing to give ourselves over to that moment of experiencing that anxiety and still say, Vero Chana Buddha. Lo Chana Buddha. And that's when these beings save us. They carry us on. So following the schedule becomes much more nuanced than waking up with the wake-up bell and coming down to Zazen. These forms that we're practicing, that we're applying ourselves to, give us the opportunity to experience ourselves and to let go of ourselves. To study yourself. When we do kinhin, to exactly explore how we walk. Are we imagining where we should go in the room and heading towards that destination? Are we alert and aware for 3 steps and then we move a little more quickly? Are we looking around the room or out the window? Are we looking for something? So, on the way down, Mark and I exposed Ian to some Buddhist conversation. And when Tom was out west sewing, he brought me a gift, which was a clearance item from the bookstore, which I didn't bring with me, but it's a collection of the writings of a man named Edward Condzett. From 1934 to some other time, of various of his essays and things that he hadn't published. That's not what this is. This is secret. Nobody can have this. Edward Condzett was an incredible Buddhist scholar. A really sort of 19th century German philologist who transcended philology. He just didn't get trapped after a while in words. And he was writing an essay about the various translators of the time, the early to mid 20th century, and how important it was that a number of them were not Buddhists. And what was important about that is that they didn't capture that the texts were not intellectual. They were not about understanding something. by knowing 2 plus 2 and the various complications of mathematics after that. You know? They were actually about describing practices and the fruits of practices. And it would be very hard for someone who was not applying themselves to the practices to actually know what the hell they were talking about after a certain point. It would only sound like Western philosophy. Then he brought up a guy named the Russian School of Translators, a guy named Shcherbatsky. Now Shcherbatsky in 1927 came out with a book called The Central Conception of Buddhism. So now for most of us, when we think about the central conception of Buddhism, which he labels as emptiness, we think that it's a concept, like a thought, that would be the center of Buddhism. But really, this is the conceiving of. So emptiness, he identifies as the central conception of Buddhism. But emptiness is that from which we emerge. It's that which gives us birth. It's our dear friend Prajnaparamita, to whom we pay homage, or homage. The nature of this conceiving is that we are able to listen and wait and to be with entirely where we are. And in that, we emerge. That's why it's so important to be willing to give up choice. At our meals, when we sit zazen, whether we like or don't like chanting, it doesn't really matter. We just chant. Whether we like or don't like bowing, we just bow. And we experience that. It's so hard for us to free ourselves of our fixation, our self-centered fixation on how things, we think, how things are. It's different from how Suzuki Roshi would say how things is. Oh, and that brings up another thing, plurals. When we do the refuges in the morning, I take refuge in the Buddha, before all being, not beings. They can't fit in the room. Before all being. Before all being. A different way of thinking about what's going on, or expressing what's going on. So that's very important. One of the other things we exposed Ian to in our little conversations, at least that I'm ripping off of, is there literally are no secrets in Zen. There literally are no secrets in Buddhism. There's no secret teaching. There's nothing that somebody whispered in my ear that I'm going to whisper in your ear someday, that then everything. We each whisper in our own ear. And we whisper in each other's ears. So this book, Dogen's Extensive Record, a translation of the Heihei Kuroku, by Dan Layton and Shohaku Okamura. It's a collection of remarkable, well, you know, this book is what, 900 pages? No, only 600, some odd. And the Shobo Genzo is two volumes of 400 pages or something. This is the other stuff outside the treasury of the true Dharma, the Shobo Genzo that those were Dogen's written lectures. Here, there are talks and things and words of encouragement he gives and poems that things he said during practice periods, like one evening, or something like that. And then some commentaries, not quite commentaries, on familiar Zen stories. Along the lines of, there's no secret, and there's nothing to whisper in your ear. A monk once asked Matsu, apart from the four propositions and beyond the 100 negations, this is serious stuff, I asked the teacher to directly indicate to me the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. Bodhidharma, the first patriarch, ancestor of Zen in China, an Indian guy, swarthy, bearded, arrives from India by boat in the south and meanders up to the middle country. The great teacher Matsu said, I'm tired today. I cannot explain it for you. Go ask Jizong. The monk asked Jizong, and Jizong said, why don't you ask the teacher? The monk said, the teacher had me come ask you. Jizong said, today I have a headache and cannot explain it for you. Go ask Brother Bajang Weihai. The monk asked Bajang Weihai, and Weihai said, when I reach here, after all, I do not understand. The monk related this to the great teacher Matsu. Matsu said, Jizong's head is white and Weihai's head is black, which clarified everything. And then Dogen writes a poem. Apart from the four propositions and beyond the 100 negations, a monk inquired of the master with refined subtlety, if not fellows from a site for selecting Buddhas, who would see that Hai and Zhang directly pointed it out? So you wonder, but what did they point out? Nothing. And that nothing that they didn't point out, or they did point out, doesn't exclude our entire experience. All of our senses and our emotions. Or our capacity to think and to be intellectual. What it does do is it relieves us from the confusion that all of that entails by allowing us to learn to be present in the very moment. So when we sit still on our little rectangles, and whether we feel like we're walking across the bottom of the ocean without any oxygen, or that we're ecstatic over the wonder of the light in the room, or the fact that our heart's beating, or that we're totally bored. Just being present to this, just having the commitment to sit still with ourselves and allow this experience to arise and fall away. How does the Dogen expression go? To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to something else. Body and mind falling away. But in the midst of body and mind falling away, we actually still feel stuff. We think we do, you know. But Zazen then becomes too, as we develop the discipline to sit still or even just remain on these rectangles, despite what we think is going on, is tremendously powerful as we begin to walk around and have interactions in the world. Because our interactions in the world are actually no different from our interactions with ourselves on these cushions, on these rectangles. And when we sit on these cushions and we allow ourselves not to act on everything we think, feel, and imagine, we also allow ourselves to experience the depth of our sadness or aloneness or joy or love. Then too we can be present with people while we can be present with one another while all sorts of things are going on. And not have to be pushed around by them. Not be controlled by them. To be able to say, oh, just let that thought go. Just put the clutch in. Let the gear spin. No action. Space. Slowly we learn to become present with the situation. The very clear-cut situation, if you've had your breakfast, you wash your bowls. If you soiled your clothes, you clean them. If a guest arrives, you welcome them. The second of the six perfections for the Bodhisattva is sila, which is often translated discipline, but it also can be translated decorum, how we carry ourselves and how we are with people. A certain sense of relaxed formality that doesn't blur relationships and introduce confusion in feelings and expressions. A certain decorum that allows the space of what, dare I say, nothing, to arise. Because it's in this space of the central conception of Buddhism that we emerge always together. And in that space, we are informed. informed. So when somebody informs you, right, they tell you the secret. But the form, like form and emptiness, informs us. The decorum allows us to be informed. The capacity to be present and still and standing and with our breath and with someone else's breath allows us to be informed by the circumstances. This is the nature of listening. It's not listening to hear something specific. It's like zazen, objectless meditation. That doesn't mean we can't, you know, have differences of opinion. But we understand the level at which opinion exists. It also doesn't mean that we shouldn't protect ourselves from the run-on karma of certain situations and other people we come across in our life. You know, that listening actually informs us that, I should step back with my left foot right now. Otherwise, the train's going to run over my toes. So this listening actually informs us about all sorts of things. And that we can come here and be silent together and allow ourselves to be informed by the form, to actually trust it, to not have to make something up about what we're doing. I'm being a good Buddhist. This is good Zen. It's so, I guess, you know, we could say it's inscrutable, the nothing that's being pointed at. But it's only inscrutable when we are looking at the world with our subject-object mind. And when we believe that the world we create and imagine and rationalize with our subject-object mind is really what's going on. Because it's much more, you know, like our intestines. Zillions of bacteria interacting, doing stuff. This is, you know, what life is. A book I've been reading called The Mushroom at the End of the World has nothing to do with psychedelics. talks about contamination. And ultimately, you know, a bodhisattva is willing to be fully contaminated by where we are and how we are. And yet, still be what? Still be living the vow. So somehow it's interesting. Our very contamination in the world, which makes us feel that we need this quiet place that's pure and clean, and we sit together with, and there's some order, is the very contamination that we're being developing the capacity to live within without losing ourselves. But we start simply with this form, to be informed by emptiness. Because in what we consider the contaminated world, it's very hard to see our vow. And we get lost. Now, a simple example of contamination is like ostensibly we're practicing Zen here, correct? However, if you brought a monk from, I don't know, Eheji here, who'd never been outside of Japan, it wouldn't make much sense to them. They'd see some elements, but it wouldn't make much sense. So we're like a it's another word that the mushroom lady, Anna Tsin, created. Sympoiesis. It's that symbiotic creation. Not autopoiesis. Self-creation. That Zen exposed to, or us exposed to, what we imagined was Zen, that's Japanese with some hint of Chinese, and we're here finding ways to relate, to be informed by this form, which has been translated and also transformed so we can actually do it. If you read in Suzuki Roshi's biography by David Chadwick, Crooked Cucumber, some of the first Zen, American Zen experiments in Japan didn't go very well. You know, in 1963 or 66 or whatever it was in Japan, nobody at Eheji spoke English. Also, nobody at Eheji was 6'4", 200 pounds. the length of the tatami mat that they sleep on in the zendo is 6 feet long, with room for a cabinet and putting your stuff away. It's hard to sleep without either your feet or your head sticking out on the meal board, for which you would be reprimanded and woken up. Plus, there's no heat. And there's winter with lots of snow, and there's summer like New Jersey. You know, 90 degrees and 100% humidity. And no air conditioning. And robes. But nobody really who can, in English, tell you how to put the robes on. And, you know, there are all these stairs you have to climb. And it's like, has anybody ever been to Boston and gone to the USS Constitution? Well, the US Constitution was built in what for the war, whatever that war of 1812 was it or something, there, the British and the Americans, old Ironsides, so a cannon ball could hit it, bounce off or something. But people were shorter then. So below decks, there are these big beams that are like 5'6" or something. They come down from the ceiling. So for regular Americans nowadays walking through there, continually up. That's sort of like it was in Japan for guys too. But what we're responding to here is much more important than being able to be fit in a Japanese monastery or our sesshin to be so strict and formal, seemingly strict and formal, like a Japanese Zen monastery. We're actually touching what we're called to touch, the central conception of Buddhism, which isn't a conception, which is about the limits of ourself and our capacity to see or control. And it's about what Suzuki Roshi used to call our inmost request. And then a couple of paragraphs later in that talk, he says, and he laughs a little bit, he says, "You'll find out that your inmost request is the Bodhisattva vow." So it's, you know, in a world where there's no bottom, in a world where everything is seeming shifting sands, we're actually calling upon ourselves to live a life of virtue based in a vow to save all sentient beings. And despite the, what did I call it? Contamination or something? It's this vow that we respect the most. And the perceived follow-through on the vow. This commitment. So, you know, here we are. How will we manifest this commitment? In our lives and in this moment. Don't worry. It's not like the end of the world. You know, it's not like, oh, I could never do it. Or, oh, that was another funny thing. I think we, Mark and I were talking about vows. So Suzuki Roshi, in one of his lectures regarding ordination, or particularly lay ordination and taking the precepts, was scratching his head about how peculiar Americans seemed to him. And that was that Americans would get the list of the vows, they'd read them and say, I could never do this, and therefore not even try. Which is totally beside the point. Nobody can do it. That's why it's worth doing. But it's also what is called of us to do, and we know that. And every moment we return to that point, that vow, that sense of the precepts, every time we renew our vows, when we do the verse of atonement and then we take the refuges, we make contact with that. And it's that continually, over and over, making contact that contaminates our life. It's turning to Vairochana Buddha in the meal chant when we're really hungry and just want to eat and want to get the hell out of the dining room so we can take a nap. It's, oh, Vairochana Buddha. Who the hell is that? I know who Shakyamuni Buddha is. Vairochana Buddha? Hello, Chana Buddha? Who are these guys? They don't mean anything. And, you know, a willingness to put up with some strangeness and no explanation. Form to be informed. To be informed by emptiness. To study the self. To forget the self. The self that creates so much confusion and separateness. There's another story, Zen story, about two monks, an older brother and a younger brother. In the early days of Zen, before they were sort of in China, before they were the accepted sort of like Buddhist thing, and they go off to pay their condolence, it's called condolence call, their respects to a benefactor who had died. And they're in their monk's outfits and they're in the house, and they're walking around the coffin, and one monk taps on the coffin, knock knock, alive or dead? And the other monk says, I'm not saying. Another one knock, and then they keep going. He knocks again, says, alive or dead? I'm not saying. And a third time, alive or dead, I'm not saying. They're walking back to the monastery, maybe it's a few miles, and the guy's just badgering him. It's an elder monk and a younger monk. The younger monk is badgering him. He wants to know. And finally he says, if you don't tell me, I'm going to punch you in the nose. Oh. These Zen stories, you know, they're so violent. So he says, I'm not saying. Punches him in the nose. And, you know, there's some blood or something. And they get back to the monastery. And the older monk says to the younger monk, you know, you probably ought to leave. Once they find out you punched me in the nose, you'll be in trouble. So he sends him off to another teacher. And he goes to that teacher and he tells him the story. Alive or dead, alive or dead. And the teacher says, I'm not saying. Then he goes to another teacher. By this time it's, excuse me, he stays with this teacher, and it's 10 years later. And he comes into the room and he asks him the same question. This is 10 years later, right? Same question. Alive or dead? Same answer. I'm not saying. At which point, the guy has some insight about this thing we're pointing at. It's nothing but... and he wants to go back to the... he's full of gratitude for the first teacher who said, I'm not saying, because it gave him the opportunity to work on this himself, to to grapple with this life fully on his own terms, with, of course, supportive community. And it's in that cooking, that information appears. So he's filled with gratitude and he wants to go back and tell the first teacher. And of course, the first teacher has died. Then this is okay. You know, we're sad, like, oh, we could be all happy for him and so on. But this is just the way of life. And all these stories, these seemingly weird stories in Zen, are about beings who are sharing a vow and realizing a commitment together. And why we respect these ancestors is because of that. Because the lineage and the idea of the lineage keeps alive this commitment of you know, the number of people you get to know, which are thousands, aren't even enough to give anybody an idea of all the people from the time of the Buddha to now who've committed ourselves to this practice. And the lineage is a way to recognize that. That's all. So, just relax. Follow the schedule. And be informed. Feel your hands, your toes, your feet, your lips, your eyeballs, your inner ear, the perspiration dripping from your forehead. Just feel that. Open the front door of your house and the back door of your house and let the thoughts and the feelings come in the front door and go out the back door. Don't offer them tea. Okay? I'll do that with you. And on the surface, oh, the other one. May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are harmless. I vow to save.